It's Friday, April 9th. I'm Stephen Fee, and this is The Pen Pod, a podcast from Pen America. On today's edition, Liberty, the latest from Caitlin Greenidge, explores reconciling ideals with reality, family, and freedom in a post-Civil War society. Our Jared Jackson has that conversation. Then, Tough Questions Friday, our Pen America CEO, Suzanne Nossel, explores the limits of corporate free speech, boycott chatter over the Beijing Olympics, and the courageous act of a young woman in Minneapolis. I'm Stephen Fee, all that coming up on the Pen Pod. A new novel inspired by the life of the first black female doctor in New York State, our Jared Jackson has that author interview.
Caitlin Greenidge's latest novel is titled Liberty. Inspired by the life of one of the first black female doctors in the United States, it explores the coming of age of Liberty Sampson, a freeborn black girl in Reconstruction era Brooklyn, and her relationship with her practicing physician mother, her marriage and journey to Haiti, and her search for true freedom as a black woman. Caitlin's debut, We Love You, Charlie Freeman, was named one of the New York Times critics' top 10 books of 2016. Caitlin Greenidge joins me now. Caitlin, thanks for coming on the Pen Pod.
Thank you so much for having me.
I figured we'd just get started. And my first question, I'm wondering, I want to begin with when the idea for the novel first came to you. When did it come into your mind? Where were you? What were you doing? And did you begin writing the novel right away? Or was it something that you put aside in favor of another project at the time?
So I worked for many years at a history museum in Brooklyn called the Weeksville Heritage Center that's in central Brooklyn. And it's dedicated to the history of Weeksville, which was a free black community in central Brooklyn, founded in 1838, 11 years after the end of slavery in New York State. And so I did many things at that job, but at one point I was working on their oral history program. And so we did a bunch of interviews with descendants of the founders of Weeksville. And one of them was this actress named Ellen Hawley, who is in her own right a wonderful historian and writer. And she had written in her memoir, her history of her family, who she can trace back to the 1790s in New York State. And one of her ancestors is Dr. Susan Smith McKinney Stewart, the first black female doctor in New York State. And she came in to sort of talk about this woman and also Sylvana Smith, who was the founder of Weeksville and the doctor's father. And then she told us this additional story about the doctor's daughter, who was her own, I believe, great grandmother, who had moved to Haiti to marry this son of the Episcopal Archbishop of Haiti, a family friend. Had moved there. The marriage had fallen apart and had come back to Brooklyn with the help of her mother in sort of a very dramatic escape. And that their family had all these letters between the mother and the daughter detailing this and sort of detailing this really tortured relationship, but ultimate love between this mother and daughter. And that for the rest of her life, this woman received letters from her family back in Haiti, sort of telling her, you are disappointing the black race by not raising your children in an intact family, even though your husband was abusive, you have to come back. If you don't, you're ruining the black race. And so Ellen Hawley herself is super smart about this stuff. And she sort of really helped frame the story and how she understood it, which is like, this is a story about black people in the late 19th, early 20th century who, in many ways were extremely extraordinary and exceptional, but how that exceptionalism really took a toll on their personal lives and their emotional lives and what they were sort of asking to those who they were in most intimate relationships to do. And that always really struck me. That was super interesting. Just the story itself was very dramatic. And I filed it away as something that I would want to write a novel about if I ever got a chance to write more than one novel. Those deeper questions about exceptionalism, about sort of what sort of tolls we place on our most intimate relationships, sort of took longer for me to tease out.
So that then leads me to my next question. And thank you for such a great answer. It's really I'm always fascinated with how the seeds for a novel germinate and come about. And so the novel is historical fiction. You know, it documents a specific time and culture and place, and it's inspired by individuals. So I'm wondering how much research you then did to prepare for writing the novel, and When did you know to put the research down and allow the creative process to take over?
I think I sort of like to sort of figure out the structure of the story first. And I really, you know, I figured out if I could find a good structure to contain a lot of this information, it would help me make those decisions a lot clearer. And so from the beginning, with really the help of my agent, Carrie Howland, she helps me think about what that structure might look like. And from the beginning, the structure was definitely going to include letters of some sort, and also was going to mimic and steal some of the beats and scenes from the story of Persephone and Demeter. And that was really helpful to clarify, because then that gave me like a structure that I could hunt across different art forms. Like that story, of course, we know it as a Greek myth, but it appears sort of across a lot of different cultures. And once I started to think about those two sort of like goddess figures, like who is Demeter, who is Persephone, it started to help me open up and think about different cultural figures from other cultures, in Haitian culture, in Black American culture, in White American culture, who could share similar traits to those characters. And then that was like a really helpful map to decide what fit into the novel and what didn't. And then if there was something that didn't necessarily map in an easy way, I could start to figure out like, why did I actually want it in the novel, and what is it emotionally or intellectually being tied to? So for me, you know, I'm a big, so far with writing fiction, I'm a big structure person. That could change, of course, depending on projects. But, you know, I like writing to what can feel like a map, because that can actually be incredibly freeing in terms of letting you get over sort of figuring out machinations or momentum. And you sort of can have the structure to stand on to start dreaming about deeper things.
Well, thinking about the characters and the structure, as you mentioned, I'm wondering how Liberty's voice came to you. You know, did you choose, like, why did you choose her to narrate the novel? Was it important to you, as opposed to, you know, an omniscient narrator? Did you start with one and then move to Liberty, or was Liberty always the voice for the novel?
She was always the voice for the novel. You know, it took a little bit of getting over my own feelings about writing in the voice of a young girl. I actually really like writing in the voices of young women and young girls, but, you know, the wider culture really sort of denigrates art that's written in the voices of young women and young girls, especially when they're not like physically suffering. And they're just sort of like living their lives, then people are sort of like, well, what's the point? This is a, you know, a teeny bop or whatever. So I wanted her voice to be that young and questioning. But I also wanted her to be questioning real, intricate problems and real intricate, things that don't really have easy answers or easy solutions. And so figuring out the voice that made sense for her, which is, you know, it's a retrospective voice, but it's still very close to her point of view in each of her time periods, was a balance to get to that sort of like deeper wisdom that comes with reflection, while keeping sort of the freshness of someone who's still growing and learning things about the world.
So then Liberty begins the novel, and she states, "I saw my mother raise a man from the dead." And, you know, it's a line of both awe and admiration. And that adoration for a mother shifts to resentment over the course of the novel, particularly when Liberty sees her light-skinned mother treat white patients who balk at Liberty's dark skin. The novel feels, at least one of the threads, the novel feels structured around this mother-daughter relationship. And can you speak on the dynamics of the mother-daughter relationship, how you sought to examine, and what you hope to reveal through this particular narrative thread?
Yeah, I mean, I think the relationships between mothers and daughters is super interesting to me, and it's a foundational relationship for me. And I think it's a way to sort of talk about how we reconcile our ideals with reality, which is what Liberty is sort of living with throughout the novel. That's her unending question. She's, if anything, she's an idealist, and she romanticizes everybody and everything around her. And in some ways, one of her questions is, how do I still contain love and care for people who disappoint me, who don't live up to my particular ideals of what they do, is my solution going to be that I just toss them away and I don't have care from them anymore? Or am I going to come to sort of like a harder and more difficult way of staying in relationship with them? And that question comes up again and again from her, and she has different answers for different relationships and answers that change over time. And I think that's sort of at the heart often of parent-child relationships in both directions, from a parental direction. You know, you spend, it's the closest relationship you will ever have with somebody in your life, in that you are watching somebody from literally the moment they are born until they are able to leave into the wider world. It's incredibly close, but you can do all that and not know your child at all, right? Like millions of people do that every day. You can do all that and literally not know that person and not care to know that person either. Millions of people do that every day, you know, have that incredible closeness and actually have no interest in knowing the interiority of this person who they've spent so much time with. On behalf of a parent, that's kind of monstrous. On behalf of a child, it's a little bit more understandable, because, you know, that's kind of the nature of being a child, is that you're supposed to have the freedom to accept all that care and develop the person that you're going to be and how you choose to be it. But, you know, part of moving from childhood to adulthood is recognizing where your parents were merely people and merely making sort of decisions with the best information they have on hand. And that even knowing all that, those decisions can still be incredibly damaging to you. And holding all of that information into one place and knowing that sort of like pat forgiveness of, you know, well, it didn't matter, is not really the answer. And holding on to all of that resentment is not really an answer either. So what's this thornier, more difficult place to rest in?
Well, you spoke about you spoke a bit about freedom in that answer, and I, you know, freedom is another core of the novel. And so, in this 19th century world, liberty is born free, yet she's still seeking her own specific kind of freedom. And you know, perhaps this is for the reader to experience and see the growth of liberty throughout from the beginning to the end of the novel. But I'm wondering, to you as the writer, what do you feel freedom means to liberty? And do you think it changes from the beginning of the novel to the end?
Yeah, I think for her, that definition is always going to be shifting. And hopefully it shifts even after the novel physically ends for her. You feel like the character is still going to be turning that over in her mind. And I think for her, you know, it's a difficult answer, especially when you're talking about freedom within a community of people, whether that community is the community of family or like a larger, you know, community of the people who live around you. You know, I think it's really easy to define freedom in terms of like stark individualism. And oftentimes in America, we believe those things are one in the same. But I wanted to sort of break those ideas apart. And what does freedom actually look like when you are in deep community and love and care with other people? And then that conversation gets a lot more difficult than just, you know, freedom means being able to say, fuck all y'all, I'm leaving. You know, like there are other modes of freedom. And what does that look like?
Well, then I hope you don't mind me following up then with this. And I'm wondering for you, you know, as a Black woman, a mother, daughter, sister, and writer, what does freedom mean to you?
I'm not sure. I don't know. I think that answer is continually evolving. For me, it means like intense accountability to those that you care for and you hope care for you. And it also means continually and rigorously questioning your basic assumptions about yourself and other people and the way the world works.
That's wonderful. Final question, and you might be too busy. I know, you know, the book is coming out and a lot of events, I'm sure. But if you have time, what are you reading now or read recently?
I read recently Let the Record Show by Sarah Schulman, which is a extensive oral history of ACT UP. I think it's going to be one of the defining books for anybody who's interested in organizing and sort of like what it means to work towards some semblance of freedom within a community It's really wonderful. I'm reading a book of short stories, After Parties by Anthony So. I'm reading his short stories. Those are absolutely wonderful. And it's a book that I sort of recommend to everybody at this point. Yeah, those are my two.
Well, thank you, Caitlin. Caitlin Greenidge is the author of Liberty, a lush, deeply weighted novel that I must say is masterfully crafted and beautifully rendered. Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us on the Pen Pod.
Thank you for having me.
Another Friday means another round of tough questions. That's where we wade through difficult questions about free speech and free expression from the past week with our CEO, Suzanne Nossel, who joins me now. Hey, Suzanne.
Hi, Stephen.
So, Suzanne, this week we've seen a number of private companies become increasingly vocal about threats to our democracy. Georgia-based Coca-Cola and Delta have spoken out against Georgia's raft of suppressive voter laws. Republicans are crying foul. Is there a limit to how private companies should speak about issues that don't seem to directly pertain to them?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we now have, you know, as you say, Mitch McConnell and other Republicans jumping up and down, infuriated that Coke and Delta and Major League Baseball have taken this stance in relation to the voter suppression law in Georgia, whereas Republicans and conservatives have for so many years advocated the idea that corporations are people, corporations have free speech rights, there can be no limitation on corporate spending in the context of elections because of those rights, you know, and now that they're using their voice in a way that, you know, that side of the aisle does not appreciate, you know, all of a sudden the reasoning is turned on its head and they're arguing that, you know, somehow this is out of line. I don't really think it's out of line. Look, these are private companies, they're private actors. You know, they have the right to use their clout as they see fit. You know, this is not a case of, you know, something that we have thought about at Penn is, you know, for example, the campaigns to get Zoom to withdraw its service for certain kinds of discussions or speakers, you know, and campaigning to exclude certain people from the platform on the basis of their ideology. You know, I think as a society, we're sort of better off when it comes to those sorts of platforms, sort of something that we think of as like a common carrier. I mean, nobody's ever called Zoom a common carrier, but I think over the last year, there's probably an argument that it is one where, we, you know, we don't want them to do this sort of ideological line drawing, but that's not really what is at stake here. You know, this is about these companies using their voice as leaders within a community, a state, with the country to speak out on something. I think it's a powerful reflection of just how the political tables have turned and evolved over the last year, that this is seen, you know, for them as an issue where they could not remain silent. I don't think they wanted to wade into this, but the you know, the politics are such that I think there is this, you know, ongoing kind of reckoning with the legacy of racial repression, and silence in the face of that is no longer considered acceptable. And so when they came under some pressure, you know, they stepped forward. So I think that's notable. I think this has got to give some measure of pause to Republican legislatures around the country that need to think about the companies with which they do business, you know, what economic consequences might ensue, you know, if they sort of touch the third rail of voter suppression. And, you know, to my mind, that is as it should be. I mean, these are, you know, to varying degrees, but efforts to undercut our democracy, to make it harder to vote, to limit who can vote. And, you know, so to the degree that is stigmatized, rejected, you know, kind of un-American, doesn't fit the values of Coca-Cola, you know, I don't think that's such a bad thing.
Yeah. Well, speaking of pressure campaigns, there was a little bit of chatter floating around this week about a potential U.S.-led boycott of the Winter Olympic Games scheduled to take place in Beijing in 2022. You know, if a country has engaged in genocide or genocidal behavior, should the U.S. not participate in Olympic Games hosted there? And how are boycotts a form of free expression?
Yeah, look, as Pan America, we actually have a longstanding policy against sort of academic or scholarly kinds of boycotts as a restraint on the free exchange of ideas. So we don't endorse the boycotts, you know, sort of as a matter of policy. You know, I think in the Olympic context, it's complicated. You know, where you would really prefer to see those considerations enter in would be when the citing of the Olympics is originally being decided. So when they're, you know, choosing between candidate cities, I think at that stage, human rights should absolutely be a factor. Now, you know, the question now is, if there is a boycott, I think what people are debating is, you know, really, how does that play out? And the history, you know, is not terribly auspicious, a kind of tit for tat boycotts during the Cold War between the U.S. And Russia, you know, that were sort of seen as, you know, I think in a sense, maybe petty or sort of not in the spirit of sporting or the Olympic spirit. I think China, you know, will absolutely go to the mat too. You know, their determination to kind of pull off the biggest, best and greatest Olympics ever will be intensified if the U.S. boycotts. I think it will escalate tensions in relations. You know, I think there is certainly something kind of unseemly about going to this, you know, grand sports celebration in the face of the repression in Xinjiang, the, you know, closing down of free speech and openness in Hong Kong and many other Chinese policies that we're concerned about both within the mainland and around the world. And so it's, I think it's a real dilemma. You know, what Nick Kristof has suggested is, well, have the athletes go, but corporations shouldn't sponsor it. Government officials shouldn't go, and the athletes should sort of speak out. You know, that is one possibility. I think one has to be sort of open-eyed about how far that's going to go. It's still going to be, a story about sports more so than politics, and China will still reap the benefits of, hosting this grand reputation burnishing event. You know, there was a campaign going back to the last Beijing Olympics to get China to accept certain human rights obligations, including the freedom of journalists to move around and do their reporting in relation to the Olympics, you know, opening up credentialing for media outlets, avoiding forced labor in the construction of Olympic facilities. And it was sort of a forceful international campaign led by Minky Warden of Human Rights Watch. And, I think it kind of put human rights on the map in relation to the Olympics and sports. But what it did not do is achieve lasting human rights gains within China. To the extent that they upheld the commitments they made, they were then kind of reversed thereafter. And then they didn't enshrine lasting change. So I think this is a tough dilemma. I ultimately think the U.S. is probably unlikely to boycott. I do think it's extremely important that civil society and governments around the world do everything possible to ensure that as the story of this Olympics is reported, that human rights is part of the narrative.
Right. Well, lastly, I want to turn to week two of the Derek Chauvin trial in Minneapolis. He's, of course, the police officer being tried for the murder of George Floyd last year. And, you know, last December, we honored Darnella Frazier, the teenager who filmed the killing, and gave her our Penn Benenson Courage Award. She testified remotely last week. And I just wonder, as we reflect on that act, will we look back on her as a pivotal figure in the fight for free expression?
I think so. I mean, I think what she emblemizes is the responsibility to bear witness that we all carry as citizens. And I think it's been really powerful to hear her and the other witnesses who were present during the murder of George Floyd speak up about what they saw, how they reacted, you know, the feelings that were evoked for them, the guilt that they now live with for not being able to intervene and save his life. I think that it's sort of a important and poignant exploration of the duties of citizenship and sort of what it means to be connected to one another. And, you know, what happens when you stumble upon something, you know, another incident that brings up something similar is the case in Times Square of the elderly Asian American woman who was attacked. And meanwhile, the security guards in an adjacent building just stood by. They've now been fired. But, you know, that was, you know, I think a chilling example where it brought back discussions of the Kitty Genovese case of so many years ago, a woman, you know, screaming for her life as, you know, supposedly the story was told that many neighbors could hear her out of their windows and no one intervened. You know, I think Darnella Frazier, in the context she was in as a 17-year-old girl, you know, out for to pick up a snack with her cousin, to have the presence of mind to say, all right, look, you know, there's a swarm of police here. You know, I'd be crazy to get physically involved, but I am going to capture all this. You know, that turned out to be such a consequential act. I mean, going back to where we started with the corporate reaction to voter suppression efforts in Georgia, you know, I think that was catalyzed by Darnella Frazier. I think, you know, what she began by posting that video and sort of setting in motion the protests against George Floyd's killing, the Black Lives Matter movement swelling up, you know, this nationwide recognition that, you know, the legacy of race is something that we have to come to grips with forcefully and immediately. The fact that in Joe Biden's infrastructure package, addressing racial inequities is, you know, a critical and integral part of the way that's going to be pursued. I honestly don't think that would have happened, or, you know, might well not have happened had it not been for this sort of chain of events and the political movement and momentum that, you know, her video first kindled. And so, you know, I think it's a great opportunity to reflect on what we each can do through expression as citizens. And I do see that part as part of, and parcel of free expression. It's not the way free expression is traditionally thought of, which is, you know, all about the government restricting your ability to speak. This is an affirmative act of expression and a demonstration of just how much power that can bring to bear.
Indeed. Well, Suzanne Nossel is our CEO here at PEN America. She's also author of Dare to Speak, Defending Free Speech for All. Thanks a lot, Suzanne.
Thanks, Stephen.
And that's our episode for Friday, April 9th. Join us next week for the PEN Pod. You can listen to all our episodes at PEN.org. Follow us at PEN America on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Also on our website, check out last night's PEN America Literary Awards Ceremony, celebrating the year's best literary talents. I'm Stephen Fee for PEN America. This is the PEN Pod. See you soon.